Shop Talk Live, episode number 217. This week, we bring on Christian Bexford, contributing editor extraordinaire. Mike and Chris have some incredible conversations in this episode. I think you're going to enjoy sitting there and listening to them as much as I did. If you were at all uncertain about the vastness of Chris Bexford's catalog, please head on over to finewoodworking.com/magazine-index and type in Bexford. It is overwhelming the number of articles that he has had in the pages of Fine Woodworking magazine, and that's for very good reason, my friends. finewoodworking.com/magazine-index. Check it out. I want to let everyone know about our newest webinar coming up, this one with our very own Mike Pekovich. It is on furniture design step by step. It's going to be Thursday, June 11th at 7 p.m. You can head on over to finewoodworking.com and sign up for that webinar. If you're not able to be there live and ask questions, you will be able to watch it after the fact on finewoodworking.com, of course. All right, on with the show. Here is Chris Bexford, Mike Pekovich, and little old me after a brief word from our sponsors. Regardless of your skill level in woodworking or home repair, you want a glue that you can trust. Because a glue that doesn't work can ruin any project in a hurry. Fortunately, TiteBond has the glue you need to get the job done with confidence. From interior glues with strong initial tack and short clamp times, to exterior glues with exceptional strength and water resistance, look to TiteBond, the right glue for your next project. For more information, visit TiteBond.com. TiteBond.com. So I decided to surprise you guys with a conversation that I didn't tell you to prepare for.
Oh, goody.
I was thinking about similarities between the career and the work of Chris Bexford, and I was thinking about those in your world, Mike. And both of you started off working in the style of other people, other designers. And over time, you have started, sorry, a huge truck just drove by. Over time, that has turned into your own distinct styles. And I think on the last podcast, Mike, we were talking about guitar players practicing scales.
Yeah.
Do you think that that applied to your work, Chris, where you were making other people's designs, you were making Shaker classics, and then over time that allowed you to have your own distinct style and add to the lexicon?
Pretty much. I mean, I'm still firmly grounded in the Shaker style, although I take liberties now and then, and I'm also heavily influenced by the Scandinavian designs.
Yeah,
both of which are relatively clean and unadorned, and I like that. I have a thing with surfaces that aren't flat and smooth. They're hard to finish and they're hard to keep clean, and I'm just not. That's just not my thing. And you're right, you develop your own vocabulary. You latch onto things that you appreciate, that you find attractive, and then you go from there. I mean, there isn't a lot of new stuff under the sun.
When I think of your whiskey cabinet and with the routed surfaces and everything, that came from...
That was just a... Let me try this.
Okay.
Because I saw someone doing, basically compass routing, but they only did it on one side. And I said, I wonder what would happen if you did it on both sides in the opposite direction. And it turned out pretty nice.
But it turned out pretty nice because you had, if for me, and I don't want to apply what I think, but I'm gonna. You had the Shaker and the Danish aesthetic to to put that loud element in a very simple piece.
Yeah, and it's the only one I've ever done like that. It made a statement, and okay, that's great, but it was a pain in the neck to finish, and it's a pain in the neck to keep clean. So a sheet of glass in there would be really nice. I've got it. Actually, that panel will come out. I can put in 5 or 6 different panels, one of which is a piece of glass with a sandblasted image of a white pine twig, mm-hmm. which I think is a lot more attractive, easier to keep clean.
Mike, what's your take? Is building things like arts and crafts classics and shaker classics, is that like practicing scales?
I would say yes and no. I came into fine furniture making through the fine arts program in college. And there, the emphasis was on coming up with something that nobody had ever seen before. So I didn't like old brown furniture. I didn't see the point in that. And then really, I kind of fell into arts and crafts furniture for a little bit. But when I came to the magazine at Fine Woodworking 24 years ago now, I really decided to stop designing for a while and kind of start from the beginning and kind of learn how to make furniture from a traditional standpoint. And for that, actually, Chris's work and his methods has been probably my biggest influence in the way I work than, anything. Stylistically and philosophically, I mentioned James Krenov and such, but Chris's work and the way he goes about it is fantastic. And I remember Chris, it was either right when I got there or shortly before I got there, you had made a little glass front bookcase. It was a little tiny thing. I think right. Vinnie Lawrence may have shot that. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But I remember working on or reading that article, and a piece that was so simple and quiet from the just looking at it at first glance, and then seeing what went into making something super simple but well made, that was, that really opened my eyes to, wow, Chris has a lot of faith and confidence in the viewer or the owner of this piece to, appreciate the workmanship that goes into something that isn't really shouting or screaming. And that was a really big lesson for me. So I'm glad you're on the show, Chris, because I finally got to say thanks very much for that. So.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't know. I don't know if I'm missing something or it's a good thing, but I never went to art school. And so the whole thing about making something you've never seen before, I had an ad in Down East for a while that said any artist can make something you've never seen before. Very few can make something that you want to live with and appreciate for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So there's a line between what's good and what's different.
Yeah.
And I grew up, my dad was a furniture maker. He was trained in Germany. So it was blueprint reading and follow directions, young man. Designing was not part of the issue. And it wasn't until I was much older, moved to Maine was more heavily influenced by the Shakers, that everything started to gel a little bit. And I started going out on tangents, wild things like the whiskey cabinet door.
Yeah, but even what a lot of people would consider like Shaker reproductions of yours, Chris, I don't think, except for maybe an odd piece that you're commissioned to do, I wouldn't say any of your stuff is exactly based on an original design. I mean, on a traditional design.
Right. Very few. I do very few actual reproductions.
Yeah.
And I try to be as faithful as possible. And I always sign my name so they don't get confused in the future. And, this is a Shaker piece. The Scandinavian influence comes to play. The corners are a little softer. And again, very few moldings, no sticky outy things, no gingerbread, none of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your kind of original question, Ben, sort of about, you know, working in traditional styles leading to an individual style, gets to Chris's point about, I think that really good design, it doesn't spring from just this, you know, this inspiration, not influenced by anything before it. I agree. I think that really good design, and for something to resonate with someone, it's got to flow from something. I think I think good design is a continuation of the past into the present, into the future. And I think a lot of my favorite designers like Chris, like Garrett Hack, Kevin Rodell, David Lamb, people who are firmly invested in traditional styles, yet still find their own voice. And in doing that, I think the truths inherent in original designs and traditional furniture, I think by re-exploring those and sort of putting a fresher face on those, I think you expose people to an appreciation of types of furniture that they may not think they like. Like a lot of people say, oh, I don't like Federal Furniture. It's all old and brown, but I really like Garrett Hack's work, you know? And it's like, well, you know, and I think that's what Garrett is, you know, taking that essence of Federal Furniture and just sort of bringing what he likes into it, what Chris is doing with Shaker Furniture and bringing his own spin to it. I think that's a super important thing. And I think that's why that work really resonates with people. They look at it and there's something familiar, but also something really fresh to it. It's like, oh, I like that. I'm not sure why, but that looks really cool. I think because it does resonate with something that they are inherently familiar with, but also they present a really fresh take on it as well.
Yeah, I think everybody's influenced by their surroundings, everything they've ever seen.
Yeah.
Nobody grows up in a vacuum.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. Someone who had no idea of what furniture was or had ever seen any other style come up with a design. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
All of a sudden I'm trying to imagine a chair without ever having seen a chair. All right. So,
and it wouldn't be a good chair either.
No, probably not.
I mean, I'm
a stump.
Yeah. I mean, we're standing on the shoulders of the shoulders of the shoulders of the shoulders of generations of people who worked really hard to come up with good solutions for this kind of stuff. And I'm just taking all that stuff, learning as much as I can, and then just, I can't be any better than anybody that's already done this. I think the only thing we can do is just try to find our own voice to lend to that conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's answer some woodworking questions now that we've gone all philosophical.
Okay.
All right, so question number one is from Ricard in Sweden. There are a few things in life that annoy me more than wood warping. You and me both, Ricard. I often buy my lumber in big slabs that I resaw, joint, and plane into boards. Sometimes, after having spent a couple of hours dimensioning my boards to perfection, I return to the shop the next day and my boards have cupped, bowed, or twisted like crazy. Does it help to clamp the boards down to prevent them from moving, or should they be stickered to allow contact with air from all sides? Should I leave the board slightly thicker than intended so I can joint them and plane them again later when the wood has settled? So this is a question we have answered many times. And you, though, Chris, you are one of the absolute authorities on lumber and milling. And this is a great opportunity to get your input.
I was fortunate enough to get a semester of wood tech in college, and that's really been a mainstay of my education.
Can you explain what exactly wood tech is?
Oh, it's basic wood anatomy, wood identification. I mean, at the end we had, you know, 40 samples lying there, and we had to name them all. And he snuck in a piece of cherry sapwood. I was the only one that got that because I work with cherry a lot. But anyway. And it also goes deep into wood structure, wood movement, moisture relationships. And it really opened up a lot of things and made my life a lot easier. a lot easier to cope with. One of the things that stuck out in that question was the resawing. When you take a wide piece, you know, let's assume it's 8/4, the interior moisture may not be the same as on the surface. So you're sawing it in half and you're suddenly exposing one side that's relatively moist, the other side that's relatively dry. And the first thing it's going to do, the moisture is going to exit that wood and it's going to shrink and it's going to cause warping. So what I would suggest is to resaw it and leave it to acclimate for a while in the shop, a week, 2 weeks, whatever it takes, you know, depending on the time of year. And then, so you're leaving it extra thick, letting it acclimate, and then doing your final milling.
So an 8/4 board, what is your expectations for a thickness you'd get out of an 8/4 board?
You'd get a very hefty, it depends on the species and it depends on the moisture content.
Okay.
You
know, right.
Okay. My reference is always Cherry, and I buy the stuff kiln dried. It comes out at 6%, and it's even the 8/4 is pretty decent inside. So when I'm resawing 8/4 Cherry, I can expect to get a minimum of 7/8 out of
finished?
Both pieces. Finished.
Okay.
Yeah. And when I buy green, I buy 4/4 and I have it plain hit or miss to 15/16, which is, you know, that's just under an inch. But it takes most of the saw, 90% of the saw marks off, leaves you with a lot of wood to work with. When you glue up panels and then have them remilled and resanded or planed, whatever you do, you're going to end up with something a little bit beefier than just 3/4.
Okay, so you're going to resaw a piece. And I don't think you only buy 8/4 if you need 8/4, right? If you're working with 3/4 stock, you're buying 4/4, right?
Yeah. I inventory just mostly 4/4, some 8/4, and then some 12 and 16, just for, you know, bedposts and things like that. But
let's hypothetical, you've got 8/4 board, you need to get some 3/4 inch stock out of it. You resaw it and then just let it rest.
Yeah, leave it sit for a couple of days.
Don't take it to the planer at all until it's rested for a while.
On the other hand, if you have a moisture meter and you pop it into both sides and they're equal, you're good to go. Okay. But if there's a big difference between the resawn side and the outside, then you're going to have to leave it sit until it, just moves and warps anything that it wants to do, and then you do your milling.
Why have I never thought of that, to take a moisture meter to the inside of a board that you just resawed? Interesting.
Because it's the first time you've heard from it from Chris.
Huh. What? How often do you pull out your moisture meter, Chris?
Very frequently. I mean, every piece I build. Because, you know, we'll go into, I mean, most of my books, and we've covered this in the articles, there's a standard formula, the width times the expected change in moisture, and the fudge number, what I call a fudge number, for each species. And it varies, and it's usually, you know, a quarter sawn will be half the fudge number of flat sawn. And it varies tremendously. And consequently, every time I build a piece, you know, I bring it down from the attic, which is unheated, but it is insulated, does have a moisture barrier. So it's pretty close. But in the dead of winter, when it's, you know, 20 below outside, I'll bring it down and let it reach ambient shop temperature. But even so, it's more moisture than temperature related. Obviously, the moisture is a relationship of the temperature, especially with humid air.
Okay. So get a moisture meter, in other words.
Yes, sir.
All right. Do you have a moisture meter, Mike?
I do. And I tend not to use it all that often. Where I do and where I've just used it, and the place I use it most commonly is if I'm bringing lumber into the shop, whether, you know, it's green stuff that's been out in a shed and it's been drying for 2 years, or if I bring it in from the lumber yard and bring it into my shop, I never know exactly what the true moisture is because I have one of those things where you have to look up on a chart and see what the species is and all that kind of stuff. But what I do is if I'm bringing in cherry, I'll check a board that's been in my shop for 6 months or a year, and then I'll check it against the stuff that just came in. And what I want to know is this thing actively releasing or absorbing moisture as I'm trying to work it? So if it's off quite a bit, I have no choice but just to let that sit around. If I bring it in and it's pretty close to stuff that I've got in the shop, then I know that it's the climate in my shop is not causing this board in the short term to do a lot of weird things as I'm trying to mill and flatten that. But so that's the main thing. I just trust that if it's been in my shop a while, it's acclimated to that current condition. And then, you know, depending on the time of the year, is the heater on? Are the windows open? Is it raining? Is it January? Is it August? You always keep track of that with an idea towards what is this piece going to be doing 6 months from now? You know, what are my drawer allowances in August compared to if I'm fitting drawers in February?
Do you change the fit of drawers and everything based on time of year, Chris?
Oh, yes. Every drawer I make, I pop the moisture meter in and apply the little formula. I got to do this 10 times for a 15-drawer chest.
Really frequently using that moisture meter.
Once a piece leaves my shop and is paid for, I never want to see it again.
Yeah.
Okay. And it may go to Seattle, Washington, and they decide to retire to Tucson, Arizona. So, what can I say?
Yeah.
You know, build it right the first time. It doesn't take that long to do the test on every drawer, every door I make. I dig out the moisture meter.
All right.
So here is, I'm holding up to a camera. Here's a drawer that is maybe an inch and a quarter high. And the drawer front is quarter sawn ash. The sides are quarter sawn brown oak. So pretty stable woods over a really short distance. And this is sitting in the little bill cubby next to my computer. And the other day, with the window open and it being kind of rainy, this drawer actually stuck. And I was like surprised. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, when is this in? Literally today, I can knock it up and down, and I probably have maybe a good 64th of an inch top to bottom clearance now. And that frightened me. That's like only over like an inch and a quarter with quarter sawn stock. And it's like, oh, shoot, that is the thing that keeps me up at night are those pieces that I've delivered to clients. And all of a sudden it's humid. And it's just like, oh, man, I hope they have air conditioning otherwise.
Yeah, working with oak, Mike, is in the great scheme of things, it's on the pretty wild side as far as wood movement goes. It's one of the reasons I like cherry is because it's relatively well-behaved. Hmm.
Yeah, I figure quarter sawn oak, at least I'm getting some benefit there.
You're getting some benefits. You're probably getting the same benefit that I'm getting out of flat sawn cherry.
And working with only inch high drawers, I figured I was getting some benefit there. Dude, I don't think I'm ever going to I'm just going to make pieces with inch drawers and just call it good.
Well, so, you know, it's an organic material. Every once in a while, it really throws you a curve. Even cherry, after 40 years of working with cherry, every once in a while, you thought you knew this, didn't you? And it just all goes to hell in the breadbasket. It just, you know, there's so many things going on in a piece of wood that you don't know about. We may get to that later. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Let's look at question number two. It is from Matt in Australia. And Matt has a lot of questions about wedge tenons. So let's just break this down into all of the separate questions. Wedge tenons. Are there any rules regarding the positioning of the wedges in relation to the edge of the tenon? I didn't understand that part so much. Do your tenons ever break or split when wedged? Should you always drill a hole at the end of the wedge cut? What thickness wedges should be used? What splay angle should be used in the mortise? So this series of questions escalates. Let's take it one step at a time.
Okay.
Are there any rules regarding the positioning of the wedges in relation to the edge of the tenon? I would assume that that means if you have a 1-inch tenon, where are you placing that wedge on a?
Don't put the wedge in the middle. Okay. The whole point of the wedge being that it wants to force the two outside pieces wider. In other words, they have to be flexible. My general rule of thumb is I make my wedges between an eighth and a quarter inch from the ends, because that little piece of wood can move, can bend when you drive in the wedge. Anything, you know, if you're an inch away, there's no way that, I don't care what kind of wedge, you drive in a steel wedge, it's not going to move an inch of wood off to the side or the up and down. It's just going to compress.
Yeah.
But it's not going to make the overall length of the tenon any bigger.
So I always thought that like twin wedge tenons were aesthetic. You're doing it for
structural reasons.
Okay. Do your tenons ever break or split when wedged?
I try not to let that happen. Again, this is getting a little farther into this other question, the geometry of how much of an angle do you have to,
answer as best fit.
Do they ever break? Yeah, I've broken them in the past. And I've split them in the past too. That's why the little hole at the bottom. Generally, when you have a saw curve and there's a hole, the split does not go on. It doesn't know where to go, to be honest with you. But the thickness of your wedge ought to be a little bit wider than the clearance on either side, the opening. In other words, the angle at the top, the splay, what I call the splay at the top and the splay at the bottom. Okay, if you're making wedges an eighth of an inch thick, make them just a hair under an eighth, the opening a little narrower than that, I'm sorry. And so that when your wedge goes in there, it will close up and you can drive it home tight. If you have a hole at the bottom, it's not going to keep going.
So do you normally, do you make your mortise with splayed sidewalls? So it actually dovetails?
A little bit, sure. You've got to. I mean, otherwise you just have a nice tight fit, and there's really no point in driving wedges. You know, if you have a good mortise and tenon joint, it's the glue that keeps it together, but the wedges actually lock it in place. So it's a mechanical fit. It's like dovetails. It's half glue, and, well, it's mostly mechanical, but the glue assures that it's not going anywhere.
Mike, do you always splay the sidewalls of your mortises?
I don't, but I also wedge for kind of a slightly, not a different reason. A lot of times I'm working with square tenons through stock, and usually anything from 1/2 inch or 3/8 inch tenon up to maybe a 3/4 inch square tenon. And if I am wedging, I will wedge, basically the wedge is always perpendicular to the grain of the board. That's being mortised, so you're not actually splitting. You never want to wedge in the same orientation of the long grain of the board with the mortise, because you can just bust that out. I just fit my tenons, and I just assume there's enough of a little wiggle room in there top to bottom to where I'll just get a wedge in there, and it expands enough. And it's sort of like Chris said, you're not really doing anything except just really kind of tightening up the joint. But I do feel that I always get that wedge in there. It goes in there. And if it's something like butternut, you know, that's, it's a little bit compressive, I think I am sort of, in essence, kind of creating that dovetail joint. I do think I'm creating some sort of mechanical lock, but that's why I don't drill the hole at the bottom of the curve, or because I don't angle the sidewalls. I'm not asking that those 10 and halves to do a lot. You know, if anything, they're maybe deflecting 64, maybe a 32nd of an inch at the very most. But normally I can get the wedge in there, you'll hammer it in, it'll kind of thunk until it rings true. And when it, once it rings true, I just figure, wow, that thing is as tight as it's going to get. And I just call that good. So it
sounds like two different methodologies where you're probably using a much more narrow wedge, Mike.
Yeah. So the wedges I use, my wedges are about an inch and a half long, and I don't go with a knife edge at the skinny part. I basically try to size that to the width of my saw kerf. Okay. Because if you're just driving a knife edge in there, that's not doing anything until that wedge is as wide as the kerf, and then it starts to open things up. Right. And what I don't want to happen is I don't want that wedge to bottom out in the kerf before it really does its work. And then so over inch and a half, it starts at the width of the kerf, so maybe like a super skinny 16th, and then it's maybe an eighth of an inch at the top. So it's not a whole, there's not a really steep angle on the wedge. So I'm basically starting as a wedge goes in. The idea is that it's sort of like at a perfect fit. And then as I'm driving it in and it goes maybe halfway in, I might be getting an overall 16th of an inch splay from that wedge. Again, because I'm hoping for a tenon which already fits pretty well, and the sidewalls of the mortise aren't angled. So I feel like it's just locking everything in place, and I can certainly take the clamps off once I get the wedges in place. One thing I found is that wedges will not seat a joint. They will not make a joint, you know, it will tighter in terms of the shoulder to shoulder distance. I find that you have to clamp it together fully seated and then drive your wedges in, as opposed to like a drawbore joint where that driving the pin in is actually socking everything together.
So, and in the other regard, you are using probably thicker wedges, Chris, right?
Yeah, my wedges go from saw curve to an 3/16. And I just want to add that in the real world, nobody makes perfect mortises. So a lot of times you have very sloppy mortises where the wedge comes through. And in my younger days, I drove wedges in every which way. I mean, I have put wedges diagonal. Yes. Hey, it closes up the, you know, I've put diagonals in. As long as you don't split the wood, I've put horizontal, vertical, all in the same one. I don't do that anymore, but it's been done. And, you know, I mean, it's a real world solution. If you have a little bit of a
yes, it is.
Nobody wants to admit it, but yeah. It's out there.
Another trick, I learned this from Mike Dunbar. He used it in doing spindles on a Windsor chair. I've done it where I wasn't planning on wedging my tenons, and I get everything together, and I felt like maybe there's just enough spring in these parts where I was afraid that glue surface on the wedge on the tenon wasn't going to hold everything together. So what I do, what I learned from Mike, is you can just take a chisel and just pop the chisel. There's my cat.
Cat's fine.
And then just pop the chisel and basically kind of split it. And then you have a knife edge wedge, which you can just jam into that little chisel crack, and you can wedge things that way. So that's sort of the after the fact wedge. It's a little dicier because usually you have glue on everything, and it's one of those, you know, last recourse things, but I've done that before.
All right. So I think we answered all of the questions about wedges from Matt in Australia. All right. So let's move on to our segment, which this week is all time favorite tool of all time for this week. Who wants to go first?
What you got, Chris?
Well, I have two of them. One of them is a power tool. The other is a hand tool. The power tool obviously is my saw stop. I think that's, if you're going to have a table saw, There are a lot of justifications for not getting a saw stop, but losing a digit is extremely costly and something you live with for the rest of your life. A saw stop is probably $300 more than a comparable, you know, Powermatic or whatever you get. It's not that much different. And it's just, it's really a huge safety factor. Plus, it's a really nice saw. It's very well made. As far as hand tools, I don't laugh, but my favorite, most used, is the moisture meter. And I owned a moisture meter before I had even had a junky table saw. Like I say, I pull that out every project I make, every drawer I make, every door that I make. It's just me. But it's extremely handy, and I couldn't live without it. I mean, you know, I love my chisels, I love my dovetail saws, all my planes, but that moisture meter.
What?
It keeps them from coming back, you know?
Yeah.
What features are you looking for in a moisture meter, then?
Accuracy. I've had mine forever and a day. It's an old Delmhorst in a metal box about yay big. You know, it's not solid state. There's, you know, all kinds of little, basically it's an ohm meter that measures the resistance between two pins. Perfectly dry wood's an insulator and water is a conductor. So the more water you have in there, the farther the needle goes. It's pretty simple. And they can do the same thing with the radio frequency ones. They don't leave holes. The holes are not a big deal to me. I usually put them in an inconspicuous place, or you put a drop of water on each of the holes and they pretty much go away. But, you know, this is pretty much an old school thing that I've had for going on 40 years. I think I'm on my third or fourth 9-volt battery. But other than that, it's done very well by me.
Chris, I was really glad when you got your saw stop, because out of every author who has ever written for Fine Woodworking magazine, you get your fingers closer to the saw blade than anybody else. And so it always is really stressful every time someone goes out for a photo shoot. So, you know, it works for you. I mean, you're comfortable with it. It works. And I think, you know, I would never, we always err on the side of wanting to show the technique the author uses. However,
I should do that.
Yeah. However, you know, we've had to ask you to use a miter gauge on some things or right. Reshoot a shot here or there. But it kind of goes to, you know, one of the knocks against a saw stop is obviously it's from people who don't own saw stops, but it's always like, oh, I know what I'm doing. Why do I need that? I always keep my fingers away from the blade. But you're a really good example of a real seasoned pro who went with a saw stop. I know Steve Latta swears by the saw stop. Every school I've ever taught at.
Especially the schools. Yeah. I mean, the insurance goes sky high.
Yeah. So is that, what was the reasoning for you? Because I'm guessing you had a pretty good saw you'd been using for a long time and were pretty happy with.
Okay. Before I got the saw stop, you know, I had a Canadian General, a good machine. I liked it a lot. And in all my years, I'd only had one misfortune with a saw blade. And so one of my fingers is a little skinnier, but there's still all 10 of them. And I figured no human being is perfect 100% of the time. Nobody.
Yeah.
And so I got one of the first saw stops, and I tend to disagree with, well, you got that safety feature, you don't have to be as careful. No.
Yeah.
The whole point is concentration. You have to concentrate every time you turn that saw on. And you know, I hate to say this, but I knew a guy that used to sharpen his fingernails with the blade running. It's how close are you willing to get? You know, close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. If you stay away from the blade, it's you know, there are a lot of safety rules. Don't go beyond the throat plate. Don't go more than 2 inches. If that makes you happy, fine. But I find that concentration, knowing the forces at work, how to shove things not only through the fence, but up against the fence. The nice thing about the saw stop also is the fact that it's got the splitter. And yes, that has, the splitter is amazing. In my old saw, I replaced the window behind the saw three times. I've not had a kickback since. And that splitter goes up and down and angles with the blade, and it's really nice. But, you know, there are things that I can get away with as long as you're concentrating, you know what's going on. And I knock on wood every day.
Yeah, I would say I wasn't really implying what you were doing was unsafe, but I would say that your expertise at
it's
the
not
tool,
a good example.
Yeah, probably is better than anyone else. And I think it really goes to the point where, you know, sort of in the contemporary conversation of hand tool versus power tools, the notion that power tools are automatic. I think your example, the way you use of a table saw, it's not automatic. I mean, it takes as much understanding of the tool and finesse and concentration to get good work from a table saw as it does from a hand plane, I think.
And you can screw up just as fast.
Yes.
I agree with you about the splitter, and I have Mike's old Unisaw, and I spent half as much on a splitter system as I did on the table saw. I won't operate a table saw, especially ripping, without a splitter. That's like getting in a car for me, and I reach over and there's no seatbelt. No, that's a no go. I'm not buying that car or whatever. And the other element too is saw stop, whatever, push sticks, having like good push sticks.
Yes.
And I was helping my brother do some siding the other day, and we had a piece I had to replicate. I go down in his basement. He's got a Unisaw down there, beautiful saw. And I, on the way down, I said, "Hey, you have push sticks down there?" He goes, "Yeah." And I pick up a push stick, and it was like a offcut of like a piece of Douglas fir that had a huge knot in the middle of it. And it was like, you've got to be kidding me. And the first thing I did was I made a push stick for him, and he came down and I looked at him. I said, "Is this your push stick?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I smashed it on the table. I said, "I did that because I love you." And it was just that, like, I think people need to really think about their push sticks too. These, you know, like an offcut of construction lumber is not going to necessarily cut it if there's a knot in the middle of it that's weak. And one thing that you do, Chris, and I know you're a big proponent of, Mike, is that every cut you make at the table saw, you are, regardless of your distance to the blade, you're most cognizant of being in control of the piece.
Yeah.
So it's not always a matter of getting far away from the blade. It's a matter of being in control of the cut at all times.
Yeah.
And I think people lose that distinction with push sticks, where it's like, "Oh, well, this gets me far away." And that doesn't mean you're safer, especially if there's a knot in the middle of the push stick.
Right.
So, but,
One of the things that, just brought something back here, the splitter, what I had meant to mention in the first question about the warping, a lot of times you're going to get reaction wood. And that's basically, you know, you've cut a piece of wood and suddenly it's parts company or binds the blade. A splitter will keep it from binding, but the reaction wood is basically trees that didn't grow straight up. In other words, leaning trees. And so on a soft wood, you're going to get compression wood on the lower side. And if you, a lot of people like to use branches. You know, I got a walnut tree and they got this nice branch, and you look at the cross section of the branch, and the pith is 2/3 of the way up, and there's these big big growth rings at the bottoms, little tiny ones up above there. That's reaction wood, and it just, there's no predicting what it's going to do. And that's one of the big causes of warping that I forgot to mention previously.
And kickback.
So splitters will keep it from binding the blade, it will not keep it from springing apart in opposite directions.
All right, Mike, what's your all-time favorite tool?
Have I mentioned a 5/8 inch open-end wrench before?
No.
That's it. You know, like the type on glue bottles with the little top that pulls up and down?
No way. 5/8.
My friend Sean, he'd actually made a little piece of plywood with the perfectly sized little U-shaped slot, and he puts that over and he can pop that up. Number one, he's never made me one, so I don't have one, and I haven't gotten around to making one myself, but I did find, instead of grabbing a pair of pliers,
it's not that hard to make, Mike.
However, I don't have to now. So 5/8 inch open end wrench, it fits the shank of that tight bond glue cap because that's actually hexagonal. So there's actually square sides to it. So just slide that wrench in there, pop it up. It's awesome. I'm almost going to buy me a dedicated 5/8 inch wrench and just hang it from a little chain by my workbench or something. So
And the older you get, the more you're going to use it.
I think they changed the glue formulation because it didn't used to be hard to open.
I don't know because I've been using Type-On 1 a lot lately. Yeah. And that stuff, like, instant. And I saw one of my Instagram buddies, Tom Howarth. He's a 3D printer guy too, and I'm dabbling in that world. And he printed like little Type-On opener doodads, and that's been on my list. But all right,
that's great.
All right,
what you got, Ben?
Mine is less mind blowing. Mine is a spare plane blade. And it could be any size, whatever, but, when we were moving out of the shop, there was just a random plane blade lying around and I grabbed it and I use it all the time. That is my replacement for, gooseneck chisels to get glue, squeeze out off. I use it for trimming things flush. It's one of those tools that I never had. And now that I have it, I reach for it multiple times a week where just for getting squeeze out of little teeny tiny areas, it's a number 5, blade. So it's like 2.5 inches wide. And mine is actually from a jackrabbit plane. So it has little ledges on the side. So you can actually grab it with your thumbs and push it in and you've got a lot of control over it. And, man, I use it all the time.
Cool.
Makes me very happy. All right, let's take a break. We'll be back in a minute.
Veritas Tools is the manufacturing arm of Lee Valley. Veritas President Robin Lee says that their aim is to ensure that the tool does not limit the expression of the person who's wielding it. To that end, Veritas takes traditional woodworking tools and makes them better in terms of ergonomics, functionality, or manufacturing materials. Veritas holds over 100 patents, which they see as proof of their innovative approach to getting more out of a tool. You can see what they've got to offer at leevalley.com.
All right, so question number 3, I picked this one because I'm partially curious as well, is from Travis. I have an 8-inch helical head joiner, and it's set to cut at about an 1/32nd of an inch deep. I've had it set like this for over a year, and I've never changed the depth of cut. I get good results, but I was wondering if changing the depth of cut is something I should do depending on the size, type of wood, or condition of the board. I am curious. Along with Travis.
Hey, let me just add my 2 cents. If you have a 6-foot long board and it's got a 1-inch bow in it, you're going to have to pass that board 32 times over your joiner to get rid of that 1-inch bow. Why not set it to a 1/4 inch and take 4 passes? I mean, if you enjoy the process more than the product, go for it. There's nothing wrong with leaving it at 32nd, but geez, you know, your time in the shop is valuable, even if you're only doing this as a hobby.
Yeah,
Running stuff over the joiner continuously is not my idea of a good time.
Yeah, that That answer, Chris, it echoed mine. My thought was, wow, this guy is way more patient than I am. I think that, yeah.
Yes.
You know, I mean, if you get through it, that's fine. I would think a 32nd of an inch, you probably don't want to go thinner than that. That's going to give you the surface that you want. But certainly, yeah, if I have, you know, if there's a lot of material to remove or some bows or cups or something, you know, I'll crank that down, you know, temporarily, like Chris was saying, just to kind of make a little bit quicker work of it. And the other thing is that I don't think that there's more wear and tear on a joiner knife taking a 16th of an inch cut as taking a 64th of an inch cut. But by leaving it at a thinner cut and taking more passes, you're putting that much more wear and tear on your knives to get where you want to go. So I think that might be, but you have a segmented cutter head, so who cares? Carbide cutters. But I know for mine with the high-speed steel knives, I try to minimize the number of passes I take on a joiner. So I am moving that, you know, that end feed table up and down quite a bit just to, like Chris was saying, you get through it pretty quick and then you set it back for that final cut, hopefully to reduce, you know, the tear out before you throw it through the planer.
So in my amateur experience, I have always... it's probably set to maybe a shy 16th, right? And I'll pass it. I'll run a board over, and it's not truing up as fast as I expect it to. That's when I lower the infeed table and take a heavier cut. And in my head, there's more like if I have the head set to a point where I need to pass it over the joiner five times, that's five times for me to screw up the pressure placement, to induce error, user error, as opposed to a heavier cut, one to two times that I can induce user error. That's how I've always thought of it. That I lower it when I feel like I'm probably the weak link. Does that make any sense?
Like Mike said, you're going to get a lot more tear out with a deeper cut, especially if the grain's going in the wrong direction or there's a knot nearby. So, you know, it's a toss up. I mean, if you have a lousy joiner and you have highly figured wood, you'll want to take a series of thinner passes. And then your final pass as thin as humanly possible to avoid the tear out. But as far as saving time, a 32nd on a live edge board.
Yeah, I was also going to say that I learned when I first learned how to use power equipment that on that first jointed face, I'm just looking to get 80% flat, just enough to create a flat reference surface for the planer. And also now, especially because my planer with a segmented cutter head leaves a much better surface than my joiner does, I'm trying to get through the joining with as little tear out as possible. So I'll skim it to get just enough that I know I have a flat bearing surface, run it through the planer, then I can flip it and then work on that face some more. So kind of to your point, Ben, I think too, you know, the more you joint, the more problems you can possibly run into, especially if your beds aren't coplanar, especially if you're getting some snipe or you have getting twist out of a board can be kind of tough. And if you don't have the right technique, you can end up with a super thin corner to the board, which you're losing your yield on that. So, yeah.
Power tools aren't automatic. Huh?
They are not automatic.
No.
That's the theme. All right. So question number four, our last question is from Ron. Let's see. I am making a small shaker style tripod table. The top attaches to the pedestal via a batten mortise to the pedestal. My question concerns the grain orientation of the top vis-a-vis the batten. If the grain directions are perpendicular, then the batten functions as a real batten and prevents the top from curling. On the other hand, If one lines up the grain direction, the 20-inch wide top and batten will move together. Assuming the top is made from quarter sawn or riff sawn stock, shouldn't the top remain flat regardless? So, Chris, do you have any experience with small shaker style tripod tables?
I've made one or two.
Okay.
And there are, basically, there are two types of attachments. The real small ones, the 16th inch, the ones with the straight posts, generally had a round collar. And as far as I know, those are few and far between. Usually about eight inches in diameter for a 16 inch diameter top. But the majority of them had a 4 inch wide batten, always going across the grain to keep it flat. And yes, you do have to ovalize the holes a little bit. You're going to get some wood movement, but even in cherry, it's going to be, over the course of a season, it's less than an eighth of an inch, so you've got a 16th on either side. You don't have to make the holes very, very large. You never glue that. You have to allow for it to move. But I've never seen one or made one with the grain going parallel to the grain of the top. That's just doesn't make any sense to me. Even if it is quarter sawn, you're not going to find an 18 inch wide quarter sawn piece. So it's got to be glued up out of individual little pieces. And I would rather have a flat sawn, maybe a cathedral grain out of a single board worst case out of a single board that's been cut into sections, so you have two halves out of the same board and you can pretty much match the grain and the color. And that's the way I usually do it, unless you have a really wide piece. But the batten always goes across the grain. And going back to the wedge issue, this is one place where I don't enlarge the hole at the top. I make a perfect fit. I spend a lot of time on the lathe to make sure the tenon fits in there exactly. You have to, squeeze it in. Then you make your saw curve, and then you pound in a wedge and glue it. And at the same time, you're also clamping it down, like Mike said, because the wedge is not going to pull it together. It's going to force the wood out. The battens go across the grain on all the pieces I've seen.
So I was think of an example of unsupported wood outside of a table. You're never going to find quarter sawn or any grain in most traditional designs unsupported. There's always going to be some sort of batten holding it in place, or a breadboard or something keeping wood from moving. So just because a board is quarter sawn doesn't mean it's not gonna.
It's not just the warping. If you stop and think about it, if your batten is going with the grain, that leaves a lot of long grain hanging unsupported. You put too much pressure on it and it's gonna crack.
It's a strength.
So it's gotta have a support underneath to keep it from flexing.
Yeah. Very interesting. I didn't think of that.
I've made a few.
So tripod tables, all sizes. How many do you think you've made?
Oh, probably 100, 120, somewhere in that neighborhood.
And recently you made one on camera for us.
So yes.
That'll be coming out.
It's still waiting to be seen.
I know.
You're doing all
right. Trying to time it just right. No, Jeff's done. This is one of the rare times that we're just waiting on timing. But so unlimited members, that'll be coming out soon. It's how many episodes, Jeff? 10?
8, I think.
Eight episodes of Chris building a small shaker stand. Yeah. Do you have anything?
I hope you left in that mortise that was a pain in the neck where the grain was going sideways and I sweated. And I mean, it's all part of you can never tell. I try to pick out some really nice straight grain piece, but if it runs off to the side and you're chiseling and it wants to break in that, but that's part of real life woodworking. And I was hoping you'd leave that in. Even people who've made 120 of those still run into problems if the wood is not cooperative.
We edited the process down from like an hour and a half to make that one.
Okay.
and we took out the cursing. And we don't have the shot of you giving me the finger at one point during that chat.
And it took out the sweat falling on the lens.
Oh, that was a fun shoot. Yeah. Mike, do you have any advice for Ron?
No, but I do have a unscripted question for Chris.
Ooh.
So, Chris, you've been woodworking for a little while now. Let's say tomorrow you won the lottery and you didn't have to make another commission piece and you were good. Would you just lock up the shop, turn off the lights and never go out there again? Or would you keep going? And if so, like what kind of stuff would you be making if your livelihood wasn't depending on what you were making in your shop?
Oh, I've thought about that a lot. Everybody thinks about winning the lottery. I would keep on woodworking. I really enjoy it. It's my man cave, you know. Things become stressful. I go out there and you sit there and you breathe and you relax and you do some woodworking, you do some planing, you do whatever it takes. But I would... The big advantage to doing this part-time or as an amateur is you can build what you want to build. Okay, I've got a backlog right now, and I have to build these pieces whether I want to or not. And they're nice pieces, but, you know, after you've built your 120th round stand, the 121st is not really that thrilling anymore. I would love to build pieces that I design and just give them away.
Very cool.
Now, you only have so many pieces in your house, and I think we've got pretty much what we need. But... Yeah, build it, enjoy it, pass it on.
Very cool.
Cool. That's good to know that it's the well has no bottom. It's just when can I finish this to get to do what I really want to do?
The next piece. Yes. Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Well, I think that about does it. I think our internet connections are probably stretched to their limits right now. We've got one listener comment from Kay Dwinfield. I've listened to all the podcasts, even though the cast has changed over the time, the information is always valuable. Thank you for that 5-star review. Does anybody have any random recommendations that they want to?
Yeah. Check out Chris's Instagram feed. It's like the best advertisement for living in Maine and being a woodworker. There is.
Well, yeah. I try to keep it. It's not only shop shots.
Yeah.
It's my life in general. And occasionally I'll show a downside, you know. Instagram tends to show a lot of perfection, and it's not always perfection. But there's a lot of good stuff going on. And, working alone, living on a dirt road, it's got its pluses, especially at this time.
You make it look pretty nice. I take my vicarious walk through the woods with you and the glass of wine and the Adirondack chair in the backyard, you know.
Come on.
It's a good prescription for life.
Thanks.
Yeah. My random recommendation is Ann Peebles' Greatest Hits. She's an artist who I totally went... I was entirely off my radar, and I was watching the new High Fidelity, the TV show on Hulu, and Ann Peebles, Can't Stand the Rain came on and was like, oh, this is it. And it's been my jam.
Cool. So,
Chris, any random recommendations?
Take it easy. Don't sweat the small stuff. Stay safe. Enjoy what you're doing. I only got so much time, so take advantage of it.
Great advice. All right, don't sweat the small stuff from Chris Bexford himself. That's all for this episode of Shop Talk Live. If you have any questions you'd like us to answer on the show, send them into shoptalk@taunton.com. If you're watching on YouTube, click that thumbs up button. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Thank you for listening. And real quick, before we totally sign off, make sure to sign up for Mike Pekovich's webinar, Furniture Design Step-by-Step, June 11th at 7 p.m. It'll be a lot of fun. We'll see you all there. It'll be live, and wish us luck.